Well, the story began in 1850 when John Gray moved to Edinburgh, Scotland. He moved to Edinburgh to become a gardener. Unable to find work, he joined the police force as a night watchman. So to keep him company through the long nights, he would take his small Skye Terrier named Bobby with him on his rounds. They became part of the living landscape of the city, night after night, year after year. John later contracted tuberculosis and died in the winter of 1858. He was buried in Greyfriars Kirkyard. What happened next became a legend in the city. Bobby, the Skye Terrier, would not leave his master's grave. Except for accepting midday meals from the kind people in the area, Bobby stayed there night and day with his master. The caretaker tried on many occasions to evict the dog, but to no avail. Finally, he provided the little dog with a shelter by the grave. When the city passed an ordinance that all unlicensed dogs would be destroyed, the Lord Provost of Edinburgh, William Chambers, purchased a license for Bobby and had a collar engraved for the little dog. Until his death, 14 years later, the citizens cared for Bobby while he guarded his master's body. If you walk to Greyfriars Kirkyard today, you can't miss the statue that stands across the street. It is a sculpture of Bobby with these words inscribed on the base. Greyfriars Bobby died 14th January 1872, aged 16 years. Let his loyalty and devotion be a lesson to us all. As I conclude this series on some of God's people, characters of the scriptures, today we think of Ruth. And one word that comes to mind when I read the book of Ruth is the word loyalty. Loyalty is something that we admire, isn't it? It's something that we aspire to. Loyalty in any relationship, no matter if it's work or family, church, even with an animal, loyalty is greatly admired and appreciated and valued. Now, we've read about Philemon and Onesimus that first week that we started this series. And 2 weeks we talked about Amos and then Habakkuk last week. We conclude with the story of Ruth, one of two books in the Bible named after a woman, Ruth and Esther. And Ruth, the book of Ruth, holds a very, very significant place in the history of Scripture. Now, we don't really know who wrote the book of Ruth. We know when it was written. It was written during the reign of King David. Some think maybe Samuel wrote the book of Ruth, but we're not sure. It was written during David's reign. It was written 100 years after the times of the judges. It takes place during the times of the judges. We know that from the opening of the book, during the times of the judges, right? Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth is the way the Old Testament goes. And her name, Ruth, means friendship. And it's the tale not only of Ruth, the book is named for Ruth, but Ruth says very little in the four chapters. It is really the story of three women, Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah. It was a dark time in Israel's history. The judges. It was a time of disobedience, idolatry, a turning away from God. There is famine, probably because as a result of God's judgment. And a Jewish man named Elimelech Elimelech and his wife Naomi decide to leave because there's no more food in the land. And so they go to a place called Moab with their two sons. The two sons marry two Moabite women. After 10 years in the land of Moab, all the men have died. Elimelech and his two sons. And so Naomi heads back to Israel with her daughters-in-laws in tow. Now, in order to capture the richness of the story, we have to just back up and do a very small historical piece on Moab. And who is Moab? Who were the Moabites? Why is that important to the story? The first mention of Moab is in Genesis 19:37. Lot leaves Sodom and Gomorrah, and you know the story. It's a sordid tale of what happens, and he gets out of Sodom and Gomorrah with his two daughters, and they end up having children, right? And Lot as the father. And so from the very beginning of one of those sons is the beginning of the tribe of Moab, the sons of Lot. From the very beginning, a cloud, a curse is on this nation. We continue through to the book of Numbers, chapter 22 and 25, and the Israelites have left Egypt. They're searching for the promised land. They're defeating all of their enemies that come across in their path. And all of a sudden, the king of Moab, a guy named Balak, he sends out one of his prophets, Balaam, to pronounce a curse on Israel. He said, these people are taking over the land, and I want you to stop this, and you go out and curse them. Well, you know the story. It's a fascinating story of Balaam. He can't curse Israel. God won't allow it, and he rides a donkey, and the donkey throws him off, and an angel blocks the path, and he ends up with the donkey actually speaking. It's a wild story. We move further to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 23, and God tells Moses in his law that no one from Moab can enter the assembly of the Lord. They can't be among God's people. We move to the book of Judges, to the time of Ruth, and for 18 years the nation of Moab oppresses and persecutes the Israelites. Saul becomes the first king, and the first order of business is defeat the Moabites, and he does. And then David lives in peace with the Moabites, but soon after David dies, it all gets stirred up again, and they begin to oppress and to attack the nation of Israel. They were a cursed people, and they were a vile people. 1 Kings and 2 Kings tells us a little bit about them, that they worshipped a god called Chemosh. Chemosh. And the worship of Chemosh was child sacrifice. Okay? Child sacrifice. And there's even one story in that book of Kings where the king of Moab, in order to win a battle against his enemies, he actually killed his firstborn son. That's how wicked these people were, okay? The prophet Isaiah, in chapter 15 and 16, he speaks against them. He predicts their judgment. He predicts their end. And in 715 BC, an Assyrian king, Sargon, comes in and does take them down and wipe them out. Isaiah prophesies against them. Jeremiah chapter 48 speaks of the judgment that will come against Moab because of their wickedness and their rejection of God. Ezekiel 25, Amos 2, all oracles against Moab. Nehemiah chapter 13. You remember Nehemiah, right? The people come out of captivity back to the land. Nehemiah, Ezra, we're going to rebuild. We're going to build the wall. We're going to start over. And Nehemiah gathers the people up in chapter 13 and he says, you know what? Now some of you guys have taken Moabite women as wives and you've had children to them. In order for the Lord to bless us, you got to send them back home. Wow. Wow. Why tell you all this? Because I think in order to appreciate Ruth, you have to understand how far she was being a Moabite, how far she was from God, how alienated she was from God. It's important to see that because when we come to the end of the story, we'll really appreciate it. But before we come to the end, and you know the end, I think, but before we come to that, I want to just note the contrasts in Ruth. And there's this huge contrast of empty and full, lack and abundance, with and without. In chapter 1, verse 21, Naomi tells her daughters, I have come away, she says, I have come away, I have was full and now I'm empty. I left being full and I return empty. I'm empty. These girls are without in so many ways. These ladies, they're without a home. They're without a home. Ruth had left her home in Israel to go to Moab. Ruth had left Moab and she's going with Naomi, and Naomi had left Israel. And so these women were without a home. They were homeless. They were without food. This idea of no food bookends the story, doesn't it? That they leave Israel because there's a famine and there's no food. And then when we get to the end of the book, Naomi and Ruth have no food. And Ruth has to go out and work in the fields of Boaz, because God said the poor without food, you have to allow them to pick up during the harvest time what falls on the ground. And that was part of God's commandment. And so Naomi sends Ruth out. They don't have any food. Home and food. They're without rest. Naomi tells her daughter-in-laws, you need to find rest. Go back. They're without husbands, without sons, without family. They're without an heir, which is a big deal in a family back then. They are without security and protection. Women alone in this society, in this world, very, very dangerous times. Very dangerous. They are empty. It's a story of emptiness, of lack. They are without happiness. There's an interesting play on the words, and Naomi says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. And Naomi means pleasant, and Mara means bitter. And so she tells them, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. I'm not happy. I'm without happiness. They're without hope. They're without hope. As Naomi explains the situation to her daughters-in-law, she said, you think I'm going to find a guy and get married and we're going to have a son and then that son will become of age and you girls can marry him and have children? I mean, that's the craziest thing you ever heard. Right? That's going to happen. That's what had to happen. They're without hope. Emptiness abounds. Well, you're familiar with the end. Boaz, who lives in Israel and is a rich guy with a farmer and lands and fields, he's what's called a kinsman redeemer. A kinsman redeemer. And Ruth goes to the fields to work for him and they fall in love. And in those days, there was something in place that was actually sounds strange to us now, but it was a good thing. Because women needed to be provided, to be protected, to be cared for, and the family needed to be cared for. And there was a process called the kinsman redeemer, and if a woman's husband died, the next of kin, the closest one in the family, would pay a price, and he would have the option to take her and her family in, take her as his wife. And she would come under his roof and his protection. Sounds strange to us, but it was really a benefit then. Well, Boaz goes to the next of kin and says, you know, do you want to do this for Ruth? And can you buy this land and do all this stuff? And the guy says, I'm not doing that, you know. So Boaz jumps in and buys the whole deal. Everything that was Elimelech's and Chilion's and Mahlon's and Naomi's and the land and the women and the whole thing. Boaz buys or redeems. And they raise up an heir. They have a son. Ruth and Boaz get married and have a son. His name is Obed. His son was Jesse. And Jesse's son was David. Right? And so when you come to the book of Matthew, when you start your New Testament in Matthew chapter 1 and you read the genealogy of Jesus, you're going to find a cursed Moabite named Ruth in that group. Well, it's the story, the overarching story of God's grace, of God's salvation. Paul said to the Gentiles, to you and I, you who were afar off, you weren't anywhere near the promises of Israel, have been brought near by the blood of Christ, the Redeemer. The kinsman redeemer. You were empty. Now you are full. Everything in the story hangs on this one point, doesn't it? I mean, you have two women, Ruth and Orpah. Both are Moabite. Both are from a people that are alienated, evil, wicked people, okay? Their land and what's going on with the Moabites. Ruth and Orpah are both from this group. Both set out to leave with Naomi. In fact, both of them start crying, have emotions and feelings. It's not an easy time. They're worked up. Both actually said no when given the opportunity to go back, right, and live with their family and their gods and the other way of life. When they were offered that, you know, Naomi said, this is a good gesture, I know, but let's be real about this. There's no future here. There's no hope. Go back home to your parents and your family, okay? Both said, no, we'll go with you. Both were physical. Orpah kissed Ruth, kissed Naomi. Ruth clung to Naomi. So far, so good, right? Pretty even. But when Naomi lays it out really what this path is going to be back to Israel and the God of Israel, when Naomi lays it out to Orpah and she lays it out to the two of them that there's a cost here, this is probably not going to work out, it doesn't look like there's much hope here, Orpah goes back. She goes back to her gods. But Ruth says, your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. And that decision changed everything. I was reading recently about George Washington and Benedict Arnold. You know the story. Both were men of action. Both were men of personal courage. Both of them were driven by a passionate ambition from an early age. Both of them were inspiring to the men that they commanded. They were great generals, great leaders, and their men followed them. Both of them won battles that were, the odds were against them, right? Both committed acts of sacrifice and endurance. Both of them were hot-tempered. One of them becomes a traitor, and the other, the father to our nation. How much is determined by those decisions, right, that we make? How much your God will be my God.